Hi, I'm Ruthie,
and I have a recorder.
Tune in Wednesdays from 4 to 5 to Out There. We'll meet people and plants around the streets and paths of Northampton, and we'll think about ways we can share the world. Here on Valley Free Radio, or archived online at weatherbeer.com/out there. Get out if you can, but if you can't get out, tune in. We don't care if they laugh at us. Let them take the bus and need a sickle for us. They can have the Cadillac and T-1-2, but give me my rocket bicycle for two. Today's show is Conversation with Dwayne, and there's Carl Meyer of Greenfield talking about the Northfield Mountain Station pumping plant, and have some little pieces that I wrote. Like, I eat everything and pass the quarter and what more. Thanks for tuning in to Out There today. I have a special guest in the studio.
Not that special.
Dwayne Rainey is back. Dwayne's been busy on Wednesdays, but he joins us today. Thanks for coming in, Dwayne.
My pleasure again.
How's the snow treating you? Any snow stories?
Yeah, I mean, when we got the snow on Monday, wasn't a great day. I think, actually, I mean, I got a pedal person route to do, and I think that this person looked at the weather before she called me, and all of a sudden felt a little sick. I was like, oh, okay, sure. I mean, anyone offers me some work, I'm just on it. But then I looked at the weather afterwards. I was already committed, and I said, ooh, I should be committed.
Yeah, it was a rough day out there Monday. I think one of my least favorite moments, I had a trailer load of dirty diapers that were quite heavy down in Bay State, and I had to take them up the hill past the high school up out of Riverside Drive. And, like, you know, the roads, they were just packed with snow, and they didn't plow until
slush.
Yeah, it was like ice, rutted, slush, frozen. And they didn't even start plowing till I don't know what time, but they started plowing late. Oh, so I had that trailer load, and I had just had these slick tires on, which works very well 99% of the time. But this just happened to be that
1%.
Exactly. And I looked at that hill going up by the high school, and that road just covered with packed snow and ice. And I was like, well, give it a shot. I'm not giving up till I can't go any further. And so I started going up the hill. I got maybe 20 yards, and my tires just spun out. There was nothing I could do. And I'm like, well, all right, I'll just unload half the load. So I took off half of the trailer load. I took off like four heavy tubs. I don't know, 100, 200 pounds. I don't even know. And I just left them at the bottom of the hill. And then with the other half of the load, I just started walking up the sidewalk with the bike and trailer, kind of dragging it up the sidewalk. And I was like, I was just looking at my toes, thinking one step after the other, one step after the other. You'll get there. Don't look ahead. You'll just get depressed. And so I'm like trudging along. And then I saw this car pull up on my left that was trying to go up the hill too. And it, as it passed me, it started going slower and slower and slower. And it got like 10 or 20 feet past me. And I saw its wheels spinning on the ice. And then it finally came to a stop. And I walked up on past it as it started to like slide and put it in reverse, and it like backed up all the way back down the hill down to Milton Street, and I was still trudging up that sidewalk.
I think I can't. Yeah, I had a problem with like slush, and my pedals were freezing. So I'm trying to get some oomph in my pedals, my foot keeps on sliding and sliding, and so it was terrible.
This motorist pulled up next to me next to a light later on in the day. And by the way, like the whole day, I was just like, okay, it's going to get easier any minute now as the day wore on. It's going to get easier. But it just kept on getting harder and harder, or not getting any easier at least. And anyway, a motorist pulled up next to me at a light and said something like, I was driving right behind one of the pedal people on their way to Valley Recycling going up South Street. Oh, poor thing.
Yeah. You know, I think one of the good things about that is with the weather, they were kind of going slow.
Yeah.
I mean, I couldn't go in a bike lane because it was just like snow.
Oh, yeah.
So I stayed close to it, but I was taking my share of the pavement. And I didn't get honked at once.
You're sure the ice, you mean?
No, I didn't get honked at once. And that was a really good thing that nobody honked at me because I would have done something.
And then you took your hand off the handlebars. You would have lost control.
No. I mean, I did two runs, but the last one was like really heavy. I was all the way down at the end of the street picking up my last pickup. And I turned around and I was trying to pedal down the street. And it's like, I was like way overweight. Not me personally, but the trailer.
The trash.
Yeah. And I got to the end of the street. I'm like, all right, now I got to take and make a shoot right across South Street to get on the right side to go down. I couldn't get any traction and this car stopped. And then I'm like, no, go. I'll just wait. Because she's going to stop and someone's going to hit her. Then it didn't look like it was going to be that much fun. And so when I finally got to the Valley Recycling, I was like, all right, I made it. And I started throwing stuff off. And then I started, like, humming and singing a little bit to myself. And everything was just rosy. And this one guy's looking at me. He's like, whoa. He didn't say anything, but I was just like, I was breaking out in song, I guess.
Because you were done.
Done. Yeah, but then, so I took the trailer back and I dusted it off and I parked it. And I was going down South Street on my bike, not fast. And I was pumping my brakes. And next thing you know, I hit some ice and me and a bike were sliding right across through the intersection sideways. And I got a foot down and I pulled myself out of that one. And I got over the side of the road like, whew. Because there's like a couple cars, you know, coming in both directions. But the trailers really stabilize you quite a bit.
Yeah, they keep you from going anywhere at all.
Yeah.
Well, as far as I know, we all got out of that one alive.
Yeah, there's a little pushing and pulling. And oh, there was one. I saw a pedal person, and she was training someone.
Mm-hmm.
And I said to her, I'm like, well, if you're training her, why isn't she pulling the trailer? So a little while later, I went up, dumped compost, and there they were putting the old on the bike.
The hitch on the trainee's bike.
And it was like, good, all right, now she's going to get some of this. But then it started snowing heavier. I left early, like 8 o'clock, I was on the road.
Yeah.
You know, only maybe an inch or so of stuff. But then towards like 1, 2, 3. It was just coming down.
Like 6 inches. With it. How much by the time the day was done?
Just, I guess like five, six inches, maybe. At least five.
Yeah. One more thing I noticed from yesterday was, I noticed in particular, like someone would say something to me or I would say something to someone and we'd just keep talking for a little while, longer than I usually expected. And then at one point I walked by reflective glass and I was like, oh, maybe they're talking longer because of the ice hanging out of my whiskers.
I've got a picture of you just got all frost, but you come in yesterday for lunch, and you could put these in a warm drink and cool it off. Just like pluck them right off. I was like, well, okay, now I'll kiss you.
All right, moving on.
Oh, I got to say one more thing. This poor woman on Isabella Street, she's a monthly pickup, and she happened to come out. I was really complimenting her. She gets once a month pickup. Oh. And she had like minimal amount of trash.
Uh-huh.
I was like, oh, that's really nice. I says, I thought it was pretty nice because last pickup and my load was late. But then I had to pick up this bag, this black bag I got from another customer. And it was full of like about 40 pounds of 50 pounds of cat litter.
Uh-huh.
You just pick it up. I don't have to look in the bag. I says, no, personally, I don't hate cats. I just hate indoor cat litter. I says, because you get a couple of houses, and next thing you know, you're going 100 pounds, 150 pounds, just cat litter in these little bags. And that puts weight on the trailer. And she's like, oh, I never thought about it. I says, yeah, but then you think about Northampton, how many people have cats in Northampton that are indoor cats? I says, forget that. Think about New York City. And they just throw it down the chute, and it's done. And she's like, wow, I never really thought about it like that. And you know something? People expand your minds.
All right. Thanks for sharing that, Duane. If you just tuned in, you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, WXOJ.
I'm your host, Ruthie. We're going to hear from Carl Meyer next of Greenfield about the Northfield Mountain Pump Storage Facility.
Hi, I'm Carl Meyer, not the big super Carl Meyer, political activist from Chicago and late of Tennessee.
Yeah, Nashville.
There you go. But I do work in politics. I've been involved since anti-nuclear movement against Seabrook. And right now we are walking close to a stretch of the Connecticut River that is absolutely being ruined by something called the Northfield Mountain Pump Storage Plant.
I'm going to interrupt this clip just to say that I was talking with Carl a few weeks ago while I was on the four-day walk to stop the Kinder Morgan NED pipeline. So we're walking and talking as part of that group during this interview.
It can produce 1,200 megawatts of electricity, but at this point it's all being produced on climate warming imported power, and it's basically done by sucking New England's great river, the Connecticut, backwards and up a hill about 1,000 feet or a mile to a 5-billion-gallon reservoir and storing it there and releasing it in these ugly pulses that sort of sweep down the river. And it can only produce power for a few hours and then it's completely depleted. But it actually cannot produce any of its own power. Basically, it was created to run on the power of the Vermont Yankee nuclear plant, the Roe nuclear plant, the Haddam Neck nuclear plant, all of which are now closed. So basically it's being running now on climate warming fossil fuels that have to be imported from outside the region in order to run New England's great river up a hill and sell it back to us when market prices peak during peak, yeah, for electricity, for peak pulses.
So, Carl, why did they build this thing to begin with?
Well, it was a money-making scheme, and they needed something to do with all that excess nuclear power that was hanging around at night. Nuclear plants can't be stopped at night, so find something to do with that extra nuclear stuff. We had nuclear bombs, and we couldn't keep dropping them, okay. So we created nuclear power, and then you have all this excess, so you come up with this crazy scheme, but it is actually the ruination of an ecosystem. Basically, the Connecticut River dies at the Turner's Falls Dam, which backs up water for the Northfield Mountain plant. There's actually, because of this plant, there's 2.5 miles of the Connecticut River that, most seasons, it's actually empty. The river is funneled through a canal, and fish can't get to Northern Massachusetts, Vermont, and New Hampshire, migratory fish during the spring runs, and there used to be thousands upon thousands. So that's what's going on with this stretch. Currently, we're relicensing, federal relicensing talks with the power company for the licenses to operate Northfield Mountain, Turner's Falls Dam, and Cabot Station, which it's quite an undertaking. It's a five-year process, but unfortunately, nobody called for the end of Northfield Mountain with the end of Vermont Yankee, the last running nuclear plant in the area.
What's it called? Northfield Mountain
Pump Storage Station. So it's on hydropower, which is the funny thing. It's run using water, using the weight of water, but it can't. It's not anything like what people believe is hydropower. They'd be much better off taking an anvil, importing electricity, and putting the anvil 1,000 feet in the air and then slowly lowering it rather than ruining a river system. It is currently owned by GDF Suez North America First Light Power, which is Gas de France, world's largest privately held power company. It's changed hands 3 times in the last decade. It is now slated to be sold to a Canadian pension fund. So basically it's a cash cow. You know, so that something I can't remember what the full name of it. Basically, you know, they're going to use it to profit for people that are sitting on their retirements by sending power down the line and using the Connecticut River as basically a money switch.
So So it was built basically for energy storage, so it could store the nighttime nuclear power energy and then release it during peak demand in the afternoons and evenings. Okay, but then the nuclear power plant, Vermont Yankee, and the others were shut down. So now they're just importing whatever electricity off the grid to to pump this water. And they pump it from the Connecticut River. They pump it up the hill. How far up the hill?
A mile.
A mile of a hill. To this, to this storage, this pond retention area, whatever.
Yeah. 5 billion gallon reservoir, hacked out of the top of a map.
And then, how do they decide? Who decides when to release it? Just by demand, by electric demand in the area?
Well, no, there's something called forward market energy auctions, right? And there's a 2-day spot market. Uh-huh. All pretty complicated.
Okay, and
2 days ahead of time. 2 days ahead of time, you can put in your bid, and power companies that think, well, we may need a little extra juice at this hour, they'll pay. And essentially, these guys can put their power on the market anytime they want, but they watch the spot market, right? And they say, we have this much power, we can sell it. When prices go up, they say, we'll sell to you. And then you put the power on the line.
So they pump it, so now the nuclear power plants are off grid. They pump it up there at times when the power is cheap?
Well, cheaper.
Cheaper.
Then
they release it when the price is higher.
Yeah, but it's not. The point is you are using New England's Great River as a giant weight. You are using, you are ruining an ecosystem in order to do this. And if we're going to import power in the future, because the 2020 forward market auctions have already happened. This power has already been sold through 2020. If we're going to import excess power from Canada, then take the river out of the middle of it.
Yeah.
Just send us the power when we need it. They have all that power. They would never, ever build something like this today.
Yeah.
It is so totally, horrendously, it is the worst possible thing that could happen to a river. This is a 420-mile long river, and it virtually dies at river mile 119 between Turner's Falls and Greenfield, and is not an ecosystem. Whereas you used to have migratory fish all the way up to Bellows Falls, Vermont, up to mile 172. Uh-huh. So it's 50 miles of river that has virtually been corralled and ruined by this particular plant being stuck in the middle of it.
So when they release the water, how does that affect the ecosystem of the water flow of this river?
There's something called the Connecticut River short-nosed sturgeon. This is what I've been sort of getting at, too. Been around since the dinosaurs. It actually tries to spawn in that 2.7 miles just downstream of the Turner's Falls Dam that holds back the water for Northfield Mountain and the Cabot Station, little smaller canal side hydro thing. And what that has done is it either impoverishes the habitat that the sturgeon spawn in, a fantastic place called the Rock Dam, which is adjacent to Turner's Falls and between Greenfield and Turner's Falls. And so the sturgeon, which have come there for virtually thousands of years to spawn, the river gets cut off so that they can hold back flow for Northfield and Cabot Station. And the females that are ready to spawn, either they're chased out of the river there, or if they're in the middle of spawning, they'll stop spawning and they won't return. This is a fabulous, their only documented natural spawning site on the river. Once they're chased out of there, because the power company just virtually cuts off the river and empties the river there, they go down and they try to spawn below the canal, the end of the Turner's Falls Power Canal, which is the 2.7 or mile long canal below Cabot Station. And depending on how many pumps they got going, because those pulses are first coming down from Northfield Mountain, they get shunted into the canal, then they get pulsed through another set of turbines down there. Depending on how many turbines they get running, those fish can either get flushed out. They might succeed in spawning, but then if they cut that water off, their young of the year eggs and embryos will end up stranded and die in the sort of the drying silts and cobbles there.
Well, with such a dismal situation, how are there any of them now at all? Are there?
It's kind of an amazing story. Like, you are asking me complex. I'm trying to describe. I know far too much about this. But anyway, they have been, those fish have been somehow able to survive there. There's about 300 fish at any given time that can reach the rock dam and that stretch of river between Turner's Falls and Greenfield, right?
300
ancient,
fish?
300.
That's like that's, nothing. That's a
crappy genetic crapshoot right there, yeah. Right? There are also about 1,200 fish that survive below the Holyoke Dam, which is at mile 86. So that's, I usually know the math, 36 miles downstream. Uh-huh. And here's the math on that. Let's go complex on this. Turner's Falls Dam was first built 1798. Turner's Falls Dam, first main stem dam across the Connecticut River. Basically wiped out a small salmon run that only been here for a couple of years because of the little ice age, right? 1798. But it cut off all the migratory fish that were heading upstream into Vermont, New Hampshire. Herring, shad, sea lamprey, etc. So 1798, things stop, but the short-nosed sturgeon can still reach its uppermost, only natural spawning site on the Connecticut, this fabulous place called the Rock Dam. Unbelievable site, ancient Indian gathering site, etc. 1848, this second big main stem dam gets completed at Holyoke, Mass., mile 86, downstream. So fish can no longer, migratory fish can never... can't get up there, although it washes out the first year, right? The thing blows up 1848. They rebuild 1849. So now you have the few fish that were left upstream of Holyoke Dam and the fish that the short-nosed sturgeon go downstream to get nutrients that are sort of in that freshwater, saltwater mixing place. They go down, you know, into Connecticut. Now those fish that are downstream can't get upstream of Holyoke. And somehow there are just enough fish that out of the 300 or 400 that remained upstream, that a few hang around and they're able to, in any given year, in all these, this is 168 years later, in all these years, they've been able to maintain a pulse of fish that have bred. And these are long-lived fish. They can live for 20 to 40 years, right? These are ancient bony fish, very cool, 2.5 feet, 3 feet long. They have scutes instead of, they're just this rough skin. They survive on freshwater clams, crayfish, snails. They're sort of bottom feeders, but they're sort of, once they reach a certain size, they have no predators. They're sort of impenetrable. They virtually were around with the dinosaurs. So anyway, they've managed to keep this pulse. But of course, once they hit maturity, they may get the spawn, maybe not. But then they all, at some point, want to go down and get those nutrients near the ocean. So they head south and generally have been going through the turbines at Holyoke Dam for the last 150 years, however, when they first started making electricity at that dam. But still, some of them make it through during high water. So you've had these disjointed populations, right? You have the fish, they're known as reproductive nulls. Every fish that goes past Holyoke cannot get back up, so they never reproduce. So I don't know if that's clear, but you somehow just enough fish have been able to sort of keep a small disjointed population, but they all have the pulse to come up here. They are so ancient and so imprinted by this site. So anyway, this year, this very spring, 2016, finally, 8 years after the federal license was given to Holyoke Dam, and they were supposed to have upstream lift that would work for short-nosed sturgeon. They were supposed to have it done by 2008. 8 years later, they have finally fulfilled their federal obligations. So a portion of those 1,200 fish that have the impulse to swim up to the rock dam are going to come upstream this year. Unfortunately, the licensing stuff that I'm involved in, we are having test flows to see if we can move American shad and other fish up into that dead reach, the 2.7 miles. And one of the flows that the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission has sanctioned as a test flow. and that the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service and the National Marine Fisheries Service, responsible agencies for the Endangered Species Act, as well as Mass Division of Fish and Wildlife Service, have said nothing about. One of those flows is 1,500 cubic feet per second, which is guaranteed not enough flow to allow those sturgeon to spawn at their ancient rock dam site. So if you go to my website, this is true, carlmeyerwriting.com/blog, you will see my protest and my answer from Vince Yerich, Director of Hydro Operations for the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, stating that we're going to go ahead with it anyway, and I will soon be posting the further protest, hoping for a new decision from them on my website, which went out Friday, March 16th or so.
If you just tuned in, that was an interview with Carl Meyer of Greenfield. We started out talking about the Northfield Mountain Pumped Storage Facility and then started talking about the sturgeon and fish and all. This is out there on Valley Free Radio. All that talk about rivers makes me want to play a river song. This is Alan Jackson.
Well, way down yonder on the Chattahoochee, it gets hotter than a hoochie-coochie. We laid rubber on the Georgia asphalt. We got a little crazy, but we never got caught. Down by the river on a Friday night, pyramid of cans and the pale moonlight. Talking about cars and dreaming about women. Never had a plan, just living for the minute. Yeah, way down yonder on the Chattahoochee, never knew how much that muddy water meant.
that was Alan Jackson. It's hard to find a country song that doesn't glorify cars, but you can't have everything. And that reminds me of a brief little conversation I had yesterday morning. Someone forwarded me an email, an article entitled "The Harsh Truth About Progressive Cities." I think is what it is. I'll just read you a couple of sentences from it. Madison, Minneapolis, Austin, Portland, San Francisco. These are America's most progressive, forward-thinking, open-minded, and social justice-focused cities. They also have the worst racial disparities in the nation and some of the worst racial segregation. Tim Wise, who's quoted in the article a bunch, believes the problem is that northern progressives come to their politics in other non-racial areas and have trouble seeing racial problems in their day-to-day lives. Anyway, so I read this article yesterday morning. I was at Smith Campus Center on my way back to Florence, and I was stewing on it, and I stopped at the red light in front of Cooley Dickinson with a trailer load of trash, and a friend of mine rides up on my left and is like, "Hey, Ruthie, I thought that was you up there," and gives me a hug and a kiss on the cheek, and is like, "How are you doing?" And I'm like, "Well, I'm deep in thought." I was like, "What do you do with places like this? Like, do you give up on them and leave, or do you stay and fight to try and make it better so it's not so like segregated places like Northampton aren't just left mostly to people who maybe don't care as much about, I don't know, like racial justice or whatever?" And my friend said, "Yeah, I'm really sorry. I'm on my way to work and I have to go, but I want to carry on that conversation, and no place is perfect." Anyway, yeah, no place is perfect. We'll keep on working on it. Let's see. And an announcement I wanted to make. Oh, did I say that this is out there on Valley Free Radio, 103.3 FM? And thanks for listening. Democracy Now! Comes up at 5, and Out There is on from 4 until 5. But there's an event coming up at the Jones Library, part of a video and film series. Thursday, April 14th, that's next Thursday at 7 p.m., American Indian Comedy Slam. And they say it's extremely funny and also recommended as one of the top 10 anti-racism films. And I'm going to play a clip from this film, American Indian Comedy Slam.
There's a word they call us now, Native Americans, which is a generic term I never liked. But we are older than America, so how can we be Native than something we are older than?
So yes, I am Native American. I'm indigenous. I'm aboriginal. I'm sick and tired of all the political correct crap. You just call me caucasially impaired. Is that better? Does that work?
And we're Eastern tribes, Iroquois confederacies, the Oneidas, Onondagas, Cayugas, Tuscarora, Mohawk, and Senecas.
My Indian name is Wambli Ohitika. I know it sounds like my dad just looked into a bowl of alphabet soup.
We shall call him.
Our bylaws of the Iroquois Confederacy is what Franklin Jefferson lifted to use what they call democracy here. So the idea of democracy, that's not imported, that's indigenous, and that came from us.
When I was in college, I took a Native American studies class, and I was the only Native American in the class, and I got a C.
We have ancient traditions that we have and still use them, and that's what keeps us strong. But at the same time, we're also modern contemporary people.
Yeah, that's right. Jewish father, Navajo son, that makes me a bargain hunter-gatherer.
I used to hear when I started, gee, I never heard of a funny Indian before. And the woman that said it, I thought, she doesn't know better. And it's also very funny, but also real sad at the same time.
A lot of Indians, we don't have a lot of body hair. I'm mixed blood, so I got some. It's like patchy, but it's can't grow a beard or nothing, man. I tried to grow a goatee once. It just looked like a smiling nutsack.
So you get around Indian people, there's always laughter. Even in times of stress, sorrow, sadness, there's always that undercurrent of humor. And something spiritual There's always something funny about it because joviality, lightness, laughter. They say laughter is the language of God.
Oh, my great-great-grandmother was the daughter of a Yaqui chief, Standing Deer. My great-great-grandfather was the son of Zapotec leader, Benito Juarez. And because of that mixture of cultures, that intermingling of indigenous bloodlines, I stand here tonight looking like Jackie Chan.
Declaration of Independence, the phrase savage Indian is written in it like 3 or 4 different times. And nobody's ever changed it or addressed it or anything. And so we get people to laugh with us instead of at us. And but we're fighting hundreds of years of stereotypes just by the very act that we're up here.
That's the trailer from a movie that's going to be showing on Thursday, April 14th at the Jones Library at 7 p.m. entitled American Indian Comedy Slam. And there's more info about this film series at comingtogether.org. That's coming-together.org. And the next thing I'm going to play for out there today is, oh, another little something I wrote.
I like to eat everything.
Yes, you do.
Like right now, I just got home to find an exciting little paper bag in the fridge. A housemate or guest must have left it, but there's no name on it, so it's fair game. Inside are 4 tiny clear plastic containers, each one with the remains of green, red, brown, and white sauces. I open the first one and scrape it into the stew I'm reheating. Zowie! Instant hot pepper stew! That bite! I open the next container of brown liquid and pour some on. Could that be tamarind? Yum. The next container is bright green. I can't tell for sure what it is, but I like it. I like to be surprised. The plastic containers are small enough that I can get my tongue inside to lick out every tasty drop and leave them clean for recycling.
Put a bowl on your head and spin it around.
I'm wondering how many little containers of flavor like this are thrown away, both takeout and what's left on people's trays. I'm thinking about how many people like me would appreciate them. People who don't like to cook, but love tasty things.
Yeah, one place you're not going to want to go is this little restaurant down in New York City. Because I just seen this. They have a refrigerator outside of their business. And they take stuff that, instead of like throwing it in to be composted, They bring it out and they put it in the refrigerator and feed the homeless. So a couple other restaurants come around and they put stuff in. And you see people and you know, open up the refrigerator, take out some and eat it in local restaurants instead of disposing it of, you know, perfectly good food just because somebody didn't sell it. And the refrigeration keeps it down to a temperature where there's not going to be any bacteria growing. And it's like clear. You can see inside and it shows people putting stuff in there and people taking stuff out and it's free.
Huh. You know what street that's on? I'm going to New York. I'll be passing through New York soon.
Yeah, I know. They didn't plan on you. Safe. So far.
Here's another story about the preciousness of food. So back in the winter, we had a cold snap with 2 consecutive nights of 10 below and the day's not much warmer. Everything froze hard, and as I put wood on the wood stove, I wondered how the wild animals were staying warm enough and fed. Dwayne said he saw a chickadee jump into a squirrel's nest.
Yeah. Opportunistic they are.
On day 3 of the cold snap, all my housemates being out of town and the house and yard being unusually quiet, I came riding into the backyard home from work. Usually the ducks and chickens hear me and the bike trailer rattling, and they come running to the gate to meet me.
For goods
and for freedom, but they didn't come. I heard them from across the pen, and I saw them huddled in the fowl house. And then I saw what looked like the silhouette of a hawk, dark against the snow, standing about 6 feet in front of the fowl house, atop a mound of something it was picking at. I grabbed a stick as I ran in the gate and chased the hawk away. It flew up into a tree branch just overhead, so I threw a frozen piece of pumpkin from the compost pile at it. And it flew up into a taller black locust tree branch. The feathery, bloody mound it had left behind was lifeless, but warm and mostly intact. I counted the remaining ducks and chickens and shut them in the fowl house and picked up Big Bertha by the legs and took her to the house. Later, Dwayne would come over and clean her, and we would have chicken soup for potluck dinner. When Dwayne was cleaning her, we wondered if she would have an unlaid egg inside. And she did.
And five more behind that. Weekly supply. Good chicken.
Yeah, each progressively smaller, ranging in size from a ping pong ball to a grape in her egg tube. But I kept thinking about that hawk. I'm sure it was a lot hungrier than me. I can get food anywhere. But it needed meat. But I can eat anything. And everything. And I do.
And you do.
Especially in late winter. I'll eat anything when the root cellar stocks are dwindling and the freezer is getting empty and I've eaten all the dried apples.
But, you know, you do have a place, because if I'm eating something and I don't, like, really like it, I can always just shuffle it off to you and you're like, you just eat it right up.
Yeah, that's because I think the whole idea of liking food, I mean, whoever invented liking food or disliking food is food. It was food. You needed to eat it.
I mean, cavemen, this good, that bad.
Well, I suppose for survival of something, you develop a taste for whether or not things are poisonous, maybe for your good health. But
yeah, you would be the guinea pig. Let Ruthie see if that's poisonous or not.
Well, now I want to take a moment to appreciate people who grow food that I've eaten in the past week. There's Michael Doctor from Winter Moon Roots in Hadley. Can't get enough of your carrots and great daikon. Ben Winter, garlic from your community garden plot. Paige Bridgens, making me tea from herbs in your yard. Kate and Ernie, I'm eating applesauce from your tree by Cooper's Corner. Andy and Marcy up the block, your tart cherries from the freezer excite my palate. Also Sherry down the block, I'm eating your raspberries, Sherry's berries. And the Fog Florence Community Gardens community gooseberry plant, they're in the freezer. VJ Prashad and Elizabeth Armstrong, ooh, are those currants in front of their house?
Now I stand to fix it, man, with all the lettuce.
Well, I'm thinking about things that people actually grew that I've eaten. Oh. But I'm sure Stan's given me some things, good
well,
things to eat, too.
River Valley Market, so that's, like, local, kind of grown probably. In the middle of winter.
Well, I'm not sure anyway. And Dwayne Rainey, tomato sauce dish from your frozen summer tomatoes.
Yeah, yes.
Oh, and Stripey and Roadrunner for laying those eggs.
And Big Bertha for making that soup.
Big Bertha, yep. Oh, yeah, speaking of Big Bertha and the chicken soup, I wanted to say something about composting meat and bones. You might have heard it said that meat and bones shouldn't be put in the compost pile because they'll attract animals. But what? It's the other alternative, like send them to the landfill? Well, in my house, we resolve this problem by eating everything off the bone that can be chewed or that any other animal might want. And then we boil them so all the good stuff gets boiled out. If there's chunks of fat, we scrape it aside or render it for sautéing things later.
Yeah, like you did with that chicken skin.
Yeah. Yeah, tendons, ligaments, marrow, skin, whatever. We boil them and eat everything we can chew and render the rest, and it's all good for you. At least if it came from a healthy source.
And you're listening to Out There on Valley Free Radio, 103.3 FM, Northampton. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Coming up at 5 o'clock. I got a few more things for today's show. One is a little piece I wrote called Past the Quarter. Before I get to that, though, the mention of Michael Doctor of Winter Moon Farm, Winter Moon Roots, reminded me. He just sent me an email. I just got it earlier today with a picture from the Washington Mall from the Jefferson Memorial that's got a National Park Service person, or at least someone wearing National Park Service uniform, with a Bikes at Work trailer that looks just like the Pedal People trailers that's loaded up with trash and recycling. So next time you go to D.C., keep a lookout for that. I want to learn more about that.
Wednesday nights, you might tune in to the Warm Heart of Africa to hear the funky, sinuous rhythms of Afrobeat. Or the pulse of Algerian rhyme music. Or the desert trance of Tuareg blues. Or Township Jive from Johannesburg. Or catchy soukous beats from the Congo. Those are just a few examples of what you might hear from 7 to 9 every Wednesday night right here on Valley Free Radio. Join me, your host, DJ Vinyl Scratch, on the Warm Heart of Africa, a celebration of African and Afro-diaspora music, culture, and history, delivered with a groove.
Welcome to Move Time Radio, presented by the Arthritis Foundation, where we say stop whatever you're doing, baby, and dance. Because movement is just one of the ways you can fight osteoarthritis pain. For more information, visit fightarthritispain.org. This message brought to you by the Arthritis Foundation and the Ad Council.
Okay, now I have a little piece I wrote called Pass the Quarter. I always try to have my bus fare ready before I leave the house. A dollar bill and a quarter, the only things in my right pocket. Especially when it's cold out and bitter air will numb bare hands fishing around in pockets for spare change. Yet somehow, yet again, I've put my bike up on the rack, I've picked up my pannier, stepped up on the bus, taken off my gloves, put my dollar in the machine, and my right hand comes out of my pocket, quarterless.
Hole in the pocket.
It must be a hole in the pocket. I take off my left glove and check my left pocket, but no change there either, just bills. The bus driver is watching me. I look at the passengers already seated on the bus and announce, "Anybody got change for a dollar?" Nobody. "Whatever," I say to the bus driver. "I'll just put in another dollar. It's still a good deal." "No, just a dollar, okay?" he says, and he starts to pull a quarter out of his pocket. Uh-oh, I think. This is probably a conflict of interests or a bad precedent. I'm not going to tell you who the bus driver was that day, but anyone who rides a V-48 knows he's the man. Really, I didn't mind paying $2. To get from Northampton to Holyoke, that's like 9 miles. And the IRS estimates that driving a car costs, on average, 57 cents a mile. So that would be about $5 in a car. As I'm standing there, starting to argue with the driver about not taking his quarter, a passenger a few seats away silently reaches out a quarter to me. "Thanks." I put it in the slot and take my seat with all my stuff. A couple minutes later, a young woman from the back of the bus comes up to me with her change purse and says, "You need change?" I give her a dollar bill, and she gives me 4 quarters. So then I turn to the man who'd loaned me the quarter and say, "Here's your quarter." He didn't say anything, just shook his head no and wagged his finger. So I sat back to enjoy the ride. But you know what? I was sullen. I was like, dude gave me a quarter, a quiet man in work clothes who I judged to most likely have less privilege than me, and I owe him. Like, in this country, the average wealth of white Americans like me is 10 times the wealth of people of his ethnic, racial, demographic. And here he is, giving me his money. It humored me to notice the part of me that was somehow thinking the world would be a more just place if I could have given him his quarter back. Really, if I was going to get statistical for micro-fairness along certain categorizations, I would have needed to pay him back 10 quarters for every quarter he gave me. Don't check my math on that. But the inequality is so much deeper, and individual human relationships so much deeper than a money exchange. Why couldn't I just accept it as an act of human kindness? Why do I have to politicize everything? Doesn't that just create more division? Am I crazy to even count quarters? I resolved to pass on the man's generosity. Pass the quarter. Actually, then I remembered that the night before, I had been standing on Pleasant Street when a man walked down the sidewalk, patting his pockets and seeming kind of flustered, and he said, "I just had a dollar in my pocket and now it's gone." I said,
"Well, that's a good one." I never use that one panhandling. Lost a buck.
I said, "I got a quarter in my pocket. That's all I got right now, but you're welcome to it if it'll make you feel any better." He took it. It lightened my pocket. So then my next little pass-the-quarter anecdote. A few days later, I went to Bridgewater State Hospital, or state prison, really, is what it is, in eastern Massachusetts to visit a friend. And when I checked in with a guard at the visiting desk, she said I'd need a quarter to get the key out of the locker where I would put my valuables. And guess what?
Hole in the pocket again.
I didn't have a quarter. I'd read all the visiting requirements carefully before I left home, but they didn't tell me I needed a quarter. 2 dimes and a nickel wouldn't do. So the guard pulled a quarter out of her pocket and gave it to me and made me keep my nickels and dimes.
She probably gets reimbursed.
Okay, I've got one more quarter anecdote. The other day I was sitting on the bench in front of Haymarket waiting for a friend, and there was a big man in a big electric wheelchair parked next to the parking meter kiosk, and he had a big plastic jar on his hand wrist that said something about appreciating random acts of kindness. A couple of women got out of their car and walked up to the parking kiosk with a confused look, and he told them something helpful. Then as they were walking away in front of where I was sitting, two quarters fell out of them onto the sidewalk. They just watched them fall and kept walking. Well, I quickly realized the man in the wheelchair didn't seem mobile enough to pick them up, so I stepped over and snatched them off the ground. "Here, you take them," I said as I put them in his jar. He held one back towards me. "Split them?" "Nah," I said. "You worked for them. I was just sitting here reading a book." So, the moral of these stories is... What do you think the moral of these stories is, Dwayne?
Sew the hole up in your pocket.
Sometimes you lose, sometimes you win, but always keep a quarter to give to a friend.
I've got a kind of a different take on that, I guess. I mean, I have to go to a laundromat, so they only take quarters.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what I use my quarters for, is my laundry.
Mm-hmm.
So if someone asks me for a quarter, I'll say, "Sure, you're going to do my laundry?" And they're like, "No," and I said, "I guess I don't have a quarter."
All right. Well, there's nothing like a quarter when you need one. And maybe we won't bridge the wealth gap quarter by quarter, but at least sharing them can warm our hearts.
All right. I got a song by Juan Luis Guerra. That was Juan Luis Guerra, El Costo de la Vida. Thanks for listening to Out There today. I've been your host, Ruthie Woodring, also Dwayne Rainey. Shared a bunch today. Stay tuned for Democracy Now! Up at 5 o'clock.